This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Good morning, Internet!
Wow, the voice was not prepared for that.
No, it wasn't.
Were you trying to do a...
Good morning, Internet! Yeah, it's still not right.
Third time?
Yeah, morning recording for Weekend Confirmed. Everybody, my name is Garnet Lee. This is Weekend Confirmed. Whenever you happen to be listening to this out there on the net, thanks very much for joining us. Excellent cast lineup this morning. America's superstar... Jeff Cannata here off of his triumphant Kickstarter.
Dude. Yes. Thanks, everybody. I sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Thank you, everybody in this room that reorganized your schedule so that we could do that this morning for me. I appreciate it.
This was for you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. No.
Isn't the morning a wonderful time to be alive and awake? And thank you, everybody who contributed it. Really, really.
That was awesome the way she did that. This was for you? Like, oh, I'm going back to bed.
Oh, well, yeah.
And the other Jeff at the end of the table,
hey,
Jeff Mattis.
Yeah, in the house, so to speak.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you see, you guys, you didn't have to wait long. Already back in the saddle?
That was a nice surprise. I'm glad to be here.
Riding
high. Glad to have you.
Yeah.
Which is exactly why, if you're in the market for an excellent freelancer out there, you should look into Indie Jeff Mattis.
Yeah, hit me up on Twitter or wherever.
I'd be glad to be your agent.
We'll talk after the show.
And, of course, you heard her already, but this does mean story time. Yeah, it's... Story time's coming.
It's coming, kids.
That's Nicole.
You're gonna have to wait a little bit.
From judging by her notes,
I took notes this time.
I think the entire fourth segment is going to be story time.
See,
no,
I thought that
quick.
Was a chemistry equation.
No, it looks like some sort of freeform beat poetry that she's.
It is a chemistry equation in a way.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, without giving it away, should we give them a little tease of what they might get?
I think they can figure it. Oot.
Okay.
Did you get that?
Get
that,
get
did
it? Yeah, figure it oot?
You can figure it oot.
It's Canadian.
It's not Canadian.
She's going to do Das Boot? Wow, that's going to be heavy.
That would be a hell of a game. You know, 6 hours in a submarine.
Just like,
enjoy that.
And then you're still in the submarine. And you're still in the submarine?
Yep, and now you're still in the submarine.
Actually, make a Das Boot game like for PC back in like the early 90s, late 80s?
That would be an exercise in insanity, I think, but... Maybe they
remember
did.
Silent Running?
Oh, yeah.
Well, remember the big one was Silent Hunter.
Oh, and is that what I'm thinking of?
Silent Hunter, which was like full-on hardcore sub-sim.
Yeah, full sim. That's back when they actually made
sims.
Real simulation games.
That is back when they made real sims.
To bring it back,
Flight
I thought
simulators.
DOS Boot was like glass boot you drink out of.
Really?
I mean,
that's something you get at like Soup and Cooch in
Soup and Cooch?
Soup and Coochie or whatever. I can't pronounce like it's this look.
Oh right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
In
like,
Hayes Valley in San Francisco in San Francisco.
Okay.
Amazing German restaurant.
You
don't want to mix those. You'll burn yourself.
Probably.
And you know you have to turn the boot.
You gotta turn the boot.
That's the key.
You gotta turn the boot. All right, we've got a great show coming up for you today. In addition to this fantastic cast, we've got great games to talk about. We will go back probably some to BioShock Infinite, but to answer Jeff Mattis's question, I think it would be best if we steered clear of spoiling the story. However, as a number of listeners pointed out, look, you can talk some about the game without spoiling the story. So we will try to...
I think it would be fun to have a full-on segment that is spoilers so people can go, okay, for the next half hour, I can either listen or not listen.
I concur. I think it's still too soon to do that without having a lot of people have to turn it off.
Well, so they turn it off and they come back to it later. It's not a...
No one comes back to podcasts. They're consuming poop.
Consuming poop.
Yeah, they're in one ear.
They get three quarters of a show.
They're in one ear and out the other.
I'm just saying. I think
you really want to do this.
I think it's fun. I think it's timely. I think for the people that have finished the game, it's a great time to talk about it. And then like 2 months later when everybody's sort of... Oh, yeah, I remember that game.
It's also one of those things where, for me, my reasons are admittedly a little selfish, but it was one of those games that I finished and I was like, dude, I need to talk to people. I mean, I sent Jeff some crazy long-ass text message about it after watching one of his summations.
It was kind of crazy, but it was
fun. All right.
It was
fun. What we will do
it's
is
like
this.
Down the rabbit hole of...
What we will do is this. We will tailgate it.
Oh. All right. Well, we got to move then.
We'll tailgate it at the end. So we'll cut the fourth.
I might have to go.
We'll cut the fourth short, and then we'll tailgate it.
All right.
All right.
Let's rock.
All right. So other games we have coming up, I played some Defiance. There's a bunch of stuff from Jeff Mattis, who's been playing games. He's got Crysis 3 on here. He's got Ni No Kuni, which I have also wrapped up. Jeff Cannata, though, he didn't tell us what he'd been playing. So
I've been playing a game that's a lot like Tetris, but it involves boxes moving from one house to another house. That's what all my systems were not attached to plugs. I moved.
Sounds like a really fun game.
It's a lot like Tetris. You're trying to fit shit in other shit,
and a lot more sweating involved.
There's a lot of sweating. Oh my god, I could tell you guys a story about
sweating? Because I'll pass.
What were the microtransactions like? Were they all cosmetic?
They were large.
Not so micro.
For the first time in my life, I hired movers because I was like, this is my first big boy move. My girlfriend and I are moving in. We're going to hire movers. And they showed up 5 hours late, and we ended up paying them and then also working our asses off just to get it done.
Oh,
so the whole idea of like, I'll pay people so I don't have to do it. No, I did it and still had to. They gave us a 10% discount.
Are you on a? Or did you move into a multi-level?
Yes.
Or there's stairs?
We're on the third floor. Yeah.
Well, so you were talking about, you know, a little bit ago as we were kicking off the show, the age of simulators, and you know another age ended this last week, and that would be the age of rock bands and guitar heroes. You know, it was a big time.
That was a flash of that soared very high and then burnt out rather quickly.
But it lasted, you know, actually, if you think about it, it lasted a really long time. What we're talking about is that Harmonix dropped the very final Rock Band DLC this past week. It was the, oh my God, I don't actually have the number. However, they built the library up to 4,246 tracks altogether. Now, that includes the user-supported Rock Band Network thing, the stuff that they came up with. So that's one way they built that up. But this is pretty astounding.
Did you, 130
million downloaded songs over 281 weeks. So it wasn't a flash in the pan. 281 weeks.
That's a lot of weeks.
That is a lot of weeks. That's in excess. That's a little over 5 years.
I think I mentioned when we went to Alex Albrecht's bachelor party, we rented a cabin and one of the things we did was set up Rock Band in one of the rooms, and I hadn't done that in, I don't even know how long, maybe a year?
Yeah.
And brought back, A, how much damn fun that game is, especially with a group of people, you know, at night with a few beers. But also, we logged onto the network to just sort of browse, like, let's download some new songs.
You're like, holy cow,
exactly.
Look at how much stuff is on here.
Holy, it was really amazing that they've managed to beef up that system so much. There's a ton of music.
When the Xbox 360 finally goes away, mine will be in a separate room as a Rock Band karaoke machine.
Wow, that's
it.
Actually,
I mean,
cool.
I've been downloading stuff ever since, you know.
I had that same moment last fall when I hadn't played Rock Band in forever and was over at a friend's house and we drug it out because it's like pre-holidays. You get a little more time. You have some friends over because people start to get together during the holidays. We're like, whoa, this is like, you could just get stuck for hours browsing through all the music.
Yeah.
But more to the point, like, that game is still really, really fun.
It is.
I don't understand how it's fallen, how it rose into our consciousness so strong. And
because it's never been anything like it.
And then subsequently, what happened?
And then it ran into a storage problem. This is purely from my own perspective, but I think it speaks to a broader truth. And that is, you just can't house plastic drums in your abode.
Sure.
Okay, I thought you were talking
small.
About the music.
No, I'm talking about the physical plastic instruments.
Well,
is, by the way, the name of my band.
Physical plastic instruments.
Well, and the honeymoon period, you know, obviously everybody gets into it and it's a big, big deal. I honestly think that they could probably bring it back in if they give it a rest. The problem, I think, is that it was sort of a ubiquitous thing for so long between Guitar Hero and Rock Band. There was never a time in the past since they launched this thing where you couldn't just go out and get a music game and get a bunch of songs. And so the uniqueness and the specialness and the, you know, here's a brand new thing. I think they've sort of plumbed the plastic instrument, you know.
And
landscape.
I think it was one of those rare instances where competition actually hurt it. And I know you were the one that was beating the drum, so to speak, of it being a service rather than a yearly game early on, Garnett. And that's, you were right on the nose that I think what killed it too was like, hey, buy a new guitar every year and here's a disc with, you know, 50 songs on it, but you got to buy that disc and to buy that new guitar that comes with it, and here's a new peripheral that you need to buy. I think it collapsed under its own weight that way.
But I mean, a new guitar hasn't, like a new actual plastic guitar. You haven't been forced to buy one of those since Rock Band 3, right?
Like, I don't think you were even forced to buy one in Rock Band 3.
Yeah, you could. I think you could. There was a SKU that was sans guitar every time. I think, but every time it was like, there's a new guitar with a new thing. There's it's got this fingerless fretboard thing, or
well,
it's got this.
See, now you're crossing streams, though. That was Guitar Hero.
Well, that's the point. Is that this competition where they kept having to one up, and there was this arms race of plastic instruments that I think was to the detriment of the idea of these games.
I mean, I think it's not that they became any less fun. I think people just get not bored, but the idea of the game, it's not in their head anymore. There's just so many other games to focus on that people aren't like, oh god, I gotta go check the Rock Band network to see what songs are up. And for Harmonix not supporting it anymore, isn't Harmonix working on something else? Is this totally a move of Rock Band's not what it used to be, and couldn't it also just be Harmonix needs to devote its attention and money and servers somewhere else?
Well, if 1,000 people were buying songs every week, still they would still be making new songs.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sign that the charts showed that they're at the point of diminishing, the point of diminishing returns, and they're on the downslope and are saying, okay, you know, the costs. And I don't know if you saw, there was a talk at either PAX or GDC that John Drake gave about how much work in negotiation and physical work it took just to get a single song into Rock Band. And it's pretty monumental.
Yeah.
You know, from the manager of the band to the band members to the label to then trying to actually source the original score.
The master recording I mean, they were using masters for all that stuff. So it was like,
and having to go back and find who wrote the song, which oftentimes the songwriter is not the same as the band. So now there's someone else who wants to get into the piece of the pie. So it was a very complex puzzle.
Then there's making that game.
Yeah, and then there's actually going in and doing all the...
I'm sure that's actually the least note charting. Difficult part.
It's not really the fun part.
Actually, note charting was really a dark science for a while there. I mean, if you talk to both the Guitar Hero and Rock Band people, they were really into like what their system was for how they placed the gems. Mm-hmm. And then also making it still fun but resonating when you're on the lower difficulties. Because as you're dropping notes out, that's where it starts to get really challenging, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're hearing all the notes in the melody, but you're only playing some of them, but it's got to be the right ones in order for it to feel right.
Yep.
And have the right movements in your hands to feel it, where it feels like, oh, I feel like I'm playing air guitar.
I'm just saying that if I had a button in my house like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends where I could push it and the wall would spin around and behind that was a fully set up Rock Band setup and I could just have it sit behind the wall and out of sight, out of mind when I don't need it, I would still be playing Rock Band a lot. It's just the fact that it's a pain in the ass to set up. It's a pain in the ass to store. They're unsightly for people that aren't video game players coming into your house. You're like, what's that weird play school set you've got set up in the corner there? It's like,
those are my drums, man.
Those are my sweet
my Fisher Price drum set. Yeah.
It's the one game that takes like, you know, oh, I got to spend 5 or 6 minutes setting this stuff up before I play.
And I got to move the furniture half the time.
You got to find the microphone and no one can ever find the microphone.
And you got to get the sandbags to put next to the drums because if you play them for 5 minutes, they start pushing away from you. So you gotta have the freaking sandbags.
Gotta make sure the smoke machine's working.
Oh, you gotta get the groupies.
Strobe lights.
Yeah. Cinder block works pretty well for that as well. I'm just saying cinder blocks. But at the same time, I think that, you know, you brought this idea, and I always thought this was the way to go. I really think that this could have been a thing that instead of being I think that you're right, but I sound like I'm trumpeting my own horn. I don't mean to, but I've been thinking about this, and like, if they had just let it become a music thing and a way to enjoy your music and not such a game thing, then I don't think they would have been drawn into this cycle and ultimately fall off cycle that is inherent to games, right?
Yeah. Yes. I
still
definitely think you're right about that. But I also think that what you said before, which is 200 and some odd weeks consecutive of putting out stuff, that's pretty good.
5 years?
I
agree. But the music business has been around a hell of a lot longer than five years.
True that.
And there's always new music coming out. There's always fun new music that would be great to put into these these things. And
every song you hear on the radio that you like, it would be fun to play in Rock Band.
Come on, Apple iTunes. There's an opening here. Make it happen. I mean, that's like the one thing that they could make that would be a...
Well, it's too late. Well,
their console's been rumored for, like, ever. So, I mean, if they ever released their own gaming console, they could have some kind of integration with that, your own iTunes library.
Totally. And if they simply released a karaoke box that allowed it interpreted iTunes stuff or whatever, allowed me to
some, like, tie-dye
download a song and for an extra
background.
Buck, I could get the karaoke version. I mean,
let someone make they could do it through Apple TV. Let someone make a Bluetooth guitar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if you, I mean, drums could
or
be next.
Or can we do like a Kinect type of guitar where it's not actually there?
No.
Yeah,
no.
Do it. Give it a shot. Or something that goes
Hate
on your fingers.
Already.
Like you put little things on your fingers. Like
haptic
little,
gloves?
Yeah. Little like, but what are the, what's the thing that's on Elizabeth's thumb?
A thimble?
Little thimbles that like when you push the
It's like use the thimbles to play the thimbles.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to, you know, cut back on space. Small living rooms.
Put it on your thumbs to play the drums.
It sells itself.
It's me playing the smallest world's smallest violin, right?
Yeah, let's be glad you didn't pull those rhymes any further. Who knows where that was going
to
go?
Put it on your parts to play the guitars.
Yeah, I wish that hadn't happened just then.
Oh, what a marketing nightmare.
It's morning time.
But I think you're right. If someone had if someone... That spider web that John showed in that diagram was indicative of how much trouble there was trying to get this stuff together. But at the same time, that's something that music people have to navigate all the time in order to get music deals done, right? I mean, that's how music gets onto Pandora and onto RDIO and onto Spotify. And there are people who do those things. And finding the right way to bridge that gap into the game business, it seems like there was still a big opportunity for something fun to be here. But it probably needed to not also need to be making a game source of income for Harmonix. Like, see that what I'm seeing as a difficulty is that yet another person comes into this business flow and says, "Oh, I'm going to make this and make some money off of it too." When you've already got so many places.
Well, you need somebody that knows how to make a fun game, and Harmonix proved that they could do that.
Yeah,
I don't think it was a.
Well, you need a label to buy Harmonix. Or to buy Harmonix's services to make it
and
for
integrate
the label.
It into a service from the music industry.
Exactly.
Yeah, but what I think this data that we started this discussion with shows is that it wasn't a music availability problem.
Oh God, no!
It was a.
Although there's still plenty more that we want.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
They talked at
no
great
doubt
length about
and,
that.
And not like, no doubt because there's plenty of no doubt songs.
There is.
But
too many.
I'm saying many myself. So.
But I would argue that it really is a problem with how the game interface works and how it fits into your life. And maybe I'm making a bigger deal about it because that's really what it was for me.
Rock Band is a lifestyle, people.
I think that's it. I really think that has a lot to do with it. It's just like, after a while, you don't want to have these freaking instruments in your house.
Well, if they weren't so... if you
Thimbles, you guys!
Don't make me rhyme again. I will.
If they were of a little more polish... and nicerly made, and you didn't just think of them as something you threw in the back of the closet behind the coats when you weren't using them.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be different?
Maybe.
But no, because I have a small living room that I share with like four other people and three dogs and a cat.
But what if you could just hang a nice looking guitar on the wall and pull it off when you wanted to use it?
It must be
or something. They're plastic instruments. I mean, they could be foldable or you know, easily disassemblable, so you could basically just turn it into a guitar case sized drum set.
Well, I mean, that worked pretty well. Guitar Hero did that with the Les Paul version, which was like the second or third guitar, where you could take the neck off, and it actually did make it a lot easier to store.
Yeah. It's got to be that George Jetson briefcase situation.
right, yeah, exactly. Just put it.
Yeah. All right, well, I hope that genre isn't completely dead, because I had a lot of fun with it, and as I think back on it, I'm like, wow, you know, I still actually really enjoy doing that.
But when's the last time you did?
Like I said, last fall.
Yeah.
Last fall, and I'm not sure why that is, other than...
Because it's a pain in the ass.
Not that it's a
pain
in
the
ass.
Dude, but it's a couple bottles of wine, some friends, and some karaoke. It's a blast.
So much fun.
It's totally fun.
And big thanks to Harmonix, because we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with that. And big thanks, of course, to Neversoft as well, and the Guitar Hero guys. They did a great job as well. I think back to, like John Dahl said, like, people say, oh, why don't they have Led Zeppelin? And then, of course, he like, we tried, man. Don't you think we wanted Pink Floyd?
Oh, don't you never thought of we never thought of Led Zeppelin in a guitar game. Right.
That's silly.
So glad you mentioned that.
Jimmy who?
Right?
Prince? If they had Prince, I would have.
They do have a lot of Jimi Hendrix on there, though. He's got like four albums on there. which is awesome.
And Billy Joel, dude. They put a bunch of Billy Joel.
Yeah.
Oh,
because they brought in the keyboard. The keyboard was so fun to play.
I think the keyboard was a fail.
Is so fun to play.
I really do feel like the keyboard was a
really
a fail. It didn't have the ease, the pick up and play that the guitar had.
No, it didn't.
Now, guitar, because guitar was available.
Well, that, yeah, I think there was,
you could turn the keyboard into a guitar, but that was just a holding option.
Yeah.
It changes everything.
I'm just saying that it really highlighted how difficult the piano really is, and even when they tried to simplify it, it's still freaking hard to play the piano.
I think it came in too late in the cycle. Like, if they had done that a lot earlier, it was by the time, I got one, but I was like, it's in my closet, you know. Mm.
You know, having played keys as I played piano when I was a kid growing up, I took to that really naturally. But I don't know that it didn't. I think it might have contributed some to the game-like barriers shifting, because that I think inspired Pro Mode, and Pro Mode mm-hmm. and the Pro Guitar and the amount of work that went into that. I wonder how well that really paid off.
Yeah,
not well, I would imagine. I mean, I don't even know anybody that plays in Pro Mode.
No, me neither.
I know. I mean, like I know people that bought the guitar and were like, "Oh, this is pretty cool." And then
I think the whole genre got caught up in this idea of, "Hey, our game could teach you how to play actual instruments,"
which is an awesome concept.
It is in theory, but it's like there's.
But I don't think it was executed properly.
The problem with learning something is that there's no shortcuts. That it really just takes fucking practice.
Right. Yeah,
and you can make a video game that tells you how to do it, but guess what? It's still going to be hard, and it's still going to be practice. No video game is going to make it easy for you to learn something for real.
Did you guys play Rocksmith?
A little bit.
Because that is the teaching tool, right? That's the teaching version of that.
And to be fair, Rocksmith persists. It's not, you know, it's still around, and it's still, I think, probably because it took that Pro Mode and made it a niche and figured out how to make a business model inside that worked for them. And they're like, oh, we're actually going to be just that game.
Right. Well, I mean, it's one of those titles where, knowing what I know about it, if I, as a gamer, were going to pick up a guitar for the first time, I'd consider that. I'd be like, you know what? This is something. I mean, it's a teaching tool. It's going to be a lot of repetition, but it's a game and it's an interface and it's got a reward and sort of a little, you know, I think it's a neat idea. But you're right, to your point, it's totally niche, and it is far more of a tool, a teaching tool or a learning tool than it is a game, I guess. But,
yeah.
So long as we're on memory lane, I suppose this would be a good time to pour one out for LucasArts.
Oh, man.
Yeah, a lot of people yesterday were asking me during the live stream how I felt about that. And I have mixed feelings. I have mixed feelings because while I am sad because they've made some of the great, greatest games of my life that I've enjoyed and certainly have fond memories, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. And I think that the Disney influence in Lucas across the board is going to end up being a net positive, I think.
If they license those titles to the
How could they not?
To the right studios.
Yeah, what's to stop them from just going to the highest bidder?
Well, nothing.
Let me put it to you this way. So first of all, for those who are wondering, Disney announced this past week that they have pulled the plug on internal development at LucasArts, ending LucasArts' long-standing, you know, great library of properties they've worked on, ranging from, you know, the adventure game era through all of the Star Wars games that
they've
produced.
Including Kinect Star Wars, their final game.
So that's where we're at with that. And if you look at Disney's background, you know, of course, they've shifted very heavily into mobile and social. Mm-hmm. So I would counter what you just said with, how long is the, you know, time to live for a touch swipe mobile Star Wars lightsaber mobile game?
Well, that's as Nicole just pointed out. How is that any worse than Kinect Star Wars? I mean, is that any?
Kinect Star Wars was sort of.
That was an experiment. We all go through that phase. Try new things. It doesn't work out sometimes.
It's the college years
I'm worried about the shift will cause instead of the focus being on how do we take these awesome properties and make really cool artistic, you know, experiences for people to have, it's going to be, how do we maximize our bottom line and how do we make the most money out of these titles
now,
for the mass market?
Why would that be? Why would you feel that way and not feel that way about the movie side?
Oh, I do feel that way about the movie side.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
But I feel like there's so much potential to exploit. I mean, Angry Birds Star Wars is already out. That's already out there.
Right.
I'm cautiously optimistic about the movie side. But until they, you know, start making something. I mean, you know,
I think that Disney, and I just feel this is an instinct and maybe it's naive of me, but I feel like they acquired all those IP and knew what they were getting and how valuable it was. And I think that they're not going to make stupid decisions. That there's no reason for them to piss on that legacy when they can infuse it with a new energy and really make it
as long
that
as the people as long as the money folks at the top understand that legacy, and even if they don't appreciate themselves, they realize what resonates with fans, you know, and it doesn't turn into a, well, everybody knows who Jar Jar is, let's make a Jar Jar game.
Because like it could be a smart decision for them could be a incredibly successful cash cow game like Spyro Skylanders. Or it could be, you know, making 1313 an awesome, you know, action adventure game. They're both smart decisions. Isn't the cash cow smartest?
Well, nobody knew that Spyro, that the Skylanders was going to be a cash cow when they made it.
True. Well, no, but now
right.
We do.
So you're saying, I think that's the cynical view, is to say, oh, they're just going to rape it for money, when LucasArts was already being raped for money. Like it wasn't like the artistic version now has just been bought out. It was already happening. So I think there's reason to be optimistic and say, there's a new company that has, there's no benefit to them in shitting this down the toilet. You know, there's a benefit to sort of really getting them into the right hands. And I think you saw that on the movie side with it, like bringing Kathleen Kennedy in and bringing J.J. Abrams in. It's like there's a care that seems to be being taken with these IP that me encouragement.
I just hope it doesn't become another Activision where they're like, oh, these are our moneymakers, let's run them into the ground for 4 years and then bye.
Well, they won't be doing anything because they're not doing any internal development, which could also be good for the industry, mm-hmm. because if they are still serious about pursuing game titles in those properties, it means they'll be putting money out into the studio space. Mm-hmm. So they'll be looking for, you know, all these studios that we see drying up and having trouble finding work. Well, suddenly there's going to be a lot of possibilities potentially for those different titles, you know, depending on what LucasArts decides they want to do. I mean, they may just want to do Star Wars. They may want to tread slowly. I would suspect, as others have, that Star Wars 1313 has a chance of being spun out someplace else and then brought back in under a properties licensing agreement.
I think that's likely, but I also think that what this shows is how far away 1313 was from being anything.
Rumored to have been Boba Fett, though.
Well, maybe.
Was First Assault rumored to be more complete or less?
I think probably less. They had some really cool people that they had brought in to work on that title that also had some Republic Commando background. So I think that title probably had a easier pitch to it. You know, a more easily identifiable vision of here's what the game wants to be and here's why it works and here's what we've done before and here's why how it'll be successful.
I think if 1313 had been anywhere close to being done, you would see it as a product.
It wasn't.
So it's not.
No. The vertical slice thing was obviously
very far away.
It was a flavor thing. So let's do this to wrap this up. As a point of context, what was your favorite LucasArts game?
I would be sort of toss up between Grim Fandango and Day of the Tentacle.
God, those are exactly the two I was going to say. Damn it.
Yeah.
Well, you can still say that. You're welcome. You want to do Grim Fandango and
Secret of Monkey Island.
Yeah.
Okay.
KOTOR counts, right?
Full Throttle would be on there too.
Full Throttle's a great game.
We're talking about LucasArts internal development.
I haven't played any of the games you mentioned.
X-Wing versus TIE Fighter.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead, Nicole.
No, I haven't played any of those.
I even loved Maniac Mansion.
Nope.
Maniac Mansion's a great game.
You know,
these are all before you were born.
I believe you guys, though.
Grim Fandango is certainly up there, and you guys didn't give a nod for Dark Forces.
Yeah, it's a good game.
That was a pretty cool game. But my point of all this was going to be that while we are vocally lamenting the passing of LucasArts, our favorites are
20 years old.
Relatively dusty memories.
Now, what do you think does this bode well for the opportunity of those franchises to resurface at other studios in some way? Or do you think it's sort of like
everything
they're dead?
Has a price. Yeah. I mean, if someone says, "Hey, I want to buy this," I don't see Disney being like, "No, never."
I'd love Schaefer to get the rights back to all those games that he worked on.
I'm sure he would too.
Yeah, no,
too
I know.
Bad.
All right, well, we'll keep the rights to do another three segments. Stick around when We Can Confirmed continues. We will have, I don't know, maybe Jeff talking about some of the games he's been playing. This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get up-to-the-minute gaming news along with thousands of HD videos and screenshots. Get into the action by creating your own profile, post updates about what you're playing, and stay connected with friends and other gamers. Tired of standing in lines? Find great deals on new and used games, pre-order upcoming titles, and get Gamefly's daily deals all from the palm of your hand. If you're already a Gamefly member, manage your game queue on the go and keep games you like with just one tap. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. Hey, everybody. Big thanks. Take a minute here out to the gang at Funimation. Josh over there sent us a really, really nice note and some copies of the Mass Effect Paragon Lost Blu-ray that they did last year in conjunction with EA.
So nice of them. And you should have seen Nicole's little face light up.
It lit up. And then there's like a single tear, but it wasn't actually a tear, but it sure looked like a tear.
What was it?
Closest thing I can get to crying.
You can't feel emotion?
No.
Sad.
Synthetic.
So Josh, much appreciated. And I just wanted to point out here, he says they're huge fans of the show there and talk about it often around the office. Knowing that Nicole and Andrea are both diehard Mass Effect fans, I wanted to make sure they've had the chance to check out the animated movie we made with EA and BioWare last year. Hopefully it helps show that romancing James Vega isn't such a horrible option after all.
This is my Friday night plans, by the way. This Blu-ray.
Thank God you got this in time.
This is great.
So much love back to you, Big D. Of course,
they just confirmed Nicole's weekend.
Those of you who didn't know or haven't listened long enough, I grew up in Dallas, so it's kind of cool to like get a little love from the hometown. Liking that much more than Tony Romo's long-term contract. Anyway, let's move right along.
Tell me about it.
Oh dear, Nicole could do draft analysis for us.
Yeah. What do you think about the final four, Nicole? Who's gonna?
A lot of surprises, but a lot of teams that we knew we expected to be there, but a few surprises that I'm actually really rooting for.
What do you think about Wichita State, though?
It's surprising.
Yeah,
I definitely didn't see it coming.
Cinderella, right?
No, absolutely. Gophers. Just gophers everywhere.
So between last show and this show, I actually also, in addition to wrapping up Infinite, which, by the way, was a really cool game to wrap up, I wrapped up a Ni No Kuni. Which,
oh, nice.
About time. I mean, I feel like I've been on the show like four times like since you started playing that game.
Well, it's like...
It's a long game. It's like 50 hours.
I put about 54 hours into it.
Oh, man.
And
that's some commitment.
And I was playing it on my own time between other games for like coverage and stuff. So, of course, you know, this was a game for me. And boy, it was one of all the games I've ever played just for me. It really, obviously because it's current, but I think more so than that, really stands out as just a super happy, enjoyable, lovely experience.
So it's more of a Ni-Yes Kuni than a Ni No Kuni.
Ni-Yes Kuni. That's terrible.
That's horrible.
That is.
I apologize to everyone for that.
So, but I, you know, rather than me like bore you with it, the ending of it is I won't say that, but it is a very rewarding game throughout that keeps so true to the spirit of any of the Miyazaki stuff that you've fallen in love with, that just has this like lovely, gets to your heart, but not so much that you feel crushed, but then it's really inspirational and has like a lovely sensibility to it. And the music's always so fantastic. The Tokyo Philharmonic did such a beautiful job with the score, and then it's all recorded. It is a moment. It is a number of moments that are beautiful.
I just started playing it. I'm loving it. I think I passed the first boss battle, so I'm really early in, but loving it.
I think you'll really enjoy it. The only thing I would say to you is to pick your familiars as you start to gain them and find the ones that you really like and make sure to focus on them. And there's a little bit of a strange shift as you get towards the end of the game, because over the course of most of the game, it's about sending your familiars into battle.
Right.
And as you get into the late stages of the game, you come into your own, so to say, as a wizard. And it's more like you're throwing them out there to buy you some time, and then you're hopping back in to really cast the spells that are going to be the tipping point in the battles.
That's cool.
I don't understand, and I just haven't played enough of the game. I plan to come back to it because I really loved it. I just don't understand how all that works with a shared health bar. I don't understand how someone can buy you time if they're getting just because they're more robust than you.
Oh, yeah.
Are.
Yeah, because they're much stronger. Because so let's say that you've built up a tank.
Yeah.
So it's imagine you're like switching roles instead of just familiar. So you put your tank familiar out there who has much higher defense, has a great shield that has like reflective capabilities. And now they're able to like, to absorb some impact while your magic is recharging. And then you drop back in and use your spell.
Right.
Or you cast someone or you put someone in who has a good debuff spell or a good group heal spell or something that you really want to use from them. But yeah, you're right. The shared health and mana bar does make for a little bit interesting dynamic back and forth. It's also kind of annoying. The most annoying part of the game, this is the piece that'll really drive you nuts.
Okay.
The most annoying part of the combat system in the game is that anytime you are taking an action, there is a time that it takes for that action to process. If during the time that it takes for that action to process, a group action takes place, so like a area of effect spell hits you or one of your teammates does like a group heal or anything that would be applied across the table, you lose that action. Now you don't lose the mana that would have gone into it, but basically it just cancels it.
Right.
So you've started casting a heal spell on yourself and then you get hit with a spell or one of your allies heals you, it breaks that. And
so do you get better at like determining the rhythm of the combat? Like, so you're like, oh, okay.
You do with bosses.
All right.
But with bosses, with bosses, it becomes very important to watch they become classic Japanese game bosses where you have to watch them, look for the tells, and then get a feel for how long does it take that guy to cast that thing. And, I need to be ready with a defense by X time. Now, you also have manual cancel. So if you get into something and then see them do a tell for something that's going to hit you before you're finished, and you know, I need to be defending,
right?
Be ready to cancel out and hop over to defend because it makes a big difference in this game.
Gotcha.
Big difference. You don't want to be caught with your guard down against the heavier boss attacks.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I'm still sort of struggling with early on in the combat is the menu of when I want to switch tabs to spells or switch to, when I'm messing with that, normally I'm just flopping familiars in and out at this point. But like when I get to the point where I'm actually trying to find a specific menu item, it
are you using the shoulder buttons?
Yeah,
you'll get the hang of it.
Yeah, it's getting better. It's just it was a thing to adjust to, I guess.
I thought the same thing, and at about 10 to 12 hours in, I realized I was doing it without thinking about it. Because the other thing is you'll memorize so that's why I was saying like stick with the familiars you want to build up, because then you'll get you'll start to memorize what slots their normal attacks that you use or defenses that you use are in.
Right.
And so, like, for instance, I knew exactly, like, I threw Mido, and the first thing I did was Warcry. So it was, like, up, left, and X. And I was like, I knew that was, like, my entry.
Right.
That was my entry to most common battles. Like, boom, 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 boom.
How big does a roster of familiars end up at,
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous? Okay. Ridiculous. So when you say focus on a few, there's going to be a lot. Because right now I've got, like, 3 or 4 familiars right now, so it's really not.
And each of them evolves to 3 states, and the final state is a choice between one of 2 options.
And the ones that you use in battle level up faster than the ones that
you have with you are the only ones that level up.
Okay, so they actually have to be.
So you have to take around right. So you have to take around the ones that you want to level up.
Good.
So that's where you could get caught. I think a lot of folks were like getting caught grinding. If you're switching guys out a lot, then you won't be they won't be leveling along fast enough, right?
Right. Interesting.
So
interesting. Oh, that's good to know, because my natural inclination would be like, oh, I got all these familiars. Like, what does this guy do? What does this guy do? And like, I'd be flipping around all the time.
And I would say, don't lock in too early, because you want to have some variety. So it's easy to a lot of the early on ones that you get don't have enough different options in magic attack and magic defense,
yeah,
and buffs and debuffs.
Yeah, pretty basic right
so,
now.
So, figure out like one or so of the ones that you like off the initial group to do your combat, and then kind of be on the hunt for, okay, what do I want to capture here to be like a magic caster? And what do I want to capture here to be like a healer, buffer, debuffer sort of support character? That'll help you out, I think.
Sweet. All right. Cool.
Anyway, okay, my question then back is, should I go back to Crisis 3?
It is still the most, the prettiest game out there in terms of realistic looking, art and stuff.
Art and stuff?
Well, I mean, I'm not done with it yet, but I am far enough into to know that when you play on the lower difficulties, it kind of, you have more flexibility in terms of what you want to do. When you play, when you start bumping it up to higher difficulty levels, you pretty much have to play it as a stealth game because the, you know, the guys are so, you know, a couple shots, you're dead.
Yep.
The problem with that is the stealth itself. I mean, the AI is pretty good, but this, there are moments you'll get into where you'll be in a big arena room with tons of guys, and you can basically break the AI. So you can shoot at a guy with an arrow, and his buddy will go, oh, what the hell's going on over here? And he'll walk over to the body, and you shoot him. And then pretty soon you have a stack of like 12 dead bodies in this one spot.
This is so weird. There's like 14 dudes over here.
Hey, you guys sleeping or what? You know,
guys,
so,
pile on Larry.
So it makes me – and it's sort of a testament to how good the AI is when it's behaving well. But it really makes you kind of want another couple of alertness states – in enemies so that when they see it, it's not just like, oh, dude is here dead, now I'm alert. It's like, oh shit, there's two bodies here, immediately into cover, scanning, you know, set up other guys.
One's a fluke, two's a trend, three's a problem.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Kill me once, shame on you. Yeah. You know. But so that's kind of the, it's still very fun. It's gorgeous to look at, but the way it nudges you into stealth, depending on what kind of a player you are, that's sort of a drawback, I think. Like, it's not quite as, you know.
But you can still play with a lot of bombast.
You can, but not on the higher difficulties.
You don't think so?
No,
because the armor isn't strong enough.
You're even with maximum armor on, you're talking a couple of hits and you're toast. So it's very much like, you know, Bo's your best friend. You're hiding in the shadows all the time, and it's very much like, which order do I take the dudes out in so that I can progress through this?
That's a little different.
Yeah.
Because I remember, at least to my memory, I remember being able to use the armor power in like run it, like dash in attacks and dash out.
Now, play on normal, it's that experience again. It's just the problem is if you boost up the difficulty, it becomes less and less viable to play that way because you become more nerfed. Like your
How did they do with the level design throughout the game? So, I mean, I've only played like the first 2 hours of the game, and the one thing that I thought was working was that even when they had smaller areas, it felt like they had a good variety of pathways through the level, but they weren't just telegraphing. They weren't so much telegraphing, oh, you have to go down this line here or this line there.
Oh, yeah. It's very, no, the level design is very good, and it's very, it's probably better than two, not quite as open as one. Obviously, I mean, one was just insanely open, but this is like a good middle ground. Some of the arenas that you get into are very, very interesting to play
Because because it was in the streets, got very funneled.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's massive, like big sections, big levels with structures in the middle and like, you know, lakes and all sorts of stuff where you have to, so you do get that open worldy thing. It's a game that I would recommend, but again, with the difficulty and the stealth action gameplay balance, it's just something to be aware of. Like,
how are the checkpoints? I think I played one of my friend's levels once, and I got pretty far, and then died, and then started way back.
Yes, the checkpoints kind of suck because they are not based on you know, you clear out a room and there are no more guys coming. You won't checkpoint until you get to the next area. So I've had a couple of, you know, one instance the other day I was playing this level. It was a big arena and it's, you know, three waves of guys. So you take out the first eight guys and then like four more guys come in. You take them out, four more guys come in. Once you cleared all those out, and I was like, I was up on a catwalk and I looked down. I'm like, oh, you know, there's a audio log or some optional collectible I could get. And I jumped off the railing, probably two stories in my nano suit and died.
And
the whole level reset. And so it was like, well, that was not so cool. And those moments kind of make you shut the game off. But you know, provided you are aware of that, you can avoid a lot of that sort of frustration. Now, on the harder difficulties, again, that becomes a, you know, a really real hurdle because you're, you know, it's a lot easier to die. So, you have to take out a lot of guys before save points. So,
lame.
Yeah, it's a little lame.
Yes, I'm really torn because the other game that there's like two games that I was playing that I need to consider going back to, and I know what you're going to say after I say this one. You're going to say
Far Cry 3. Just do it, because I just went back to Far Cry 3 again too.
It's like he was reading my like looked into my eyes.
Can you do me a favor before you play Crysis 3? Can you play Crysis 2? It's so good.
I just don't think that's going to happen. I think you're asking a lot of him.
So you want me to go back? So I've started Crisis 3, but you want me to go back to Crisis 2, play Crisis 2, and then play Crisis 3?
I haven't played Crisis 3. It was sort of in a weird position. I was traveling when it came out, and it sort of missed my...
Play it on PC. It is beautiful.
Yeah. I want to play it, but from what I understand and what it seems like to me, it's nowhere near as good as 2.
I'm enjoying it about the same, but maybe I'm not the right person to ask because...
I loved to. I thought it was awesome.
Oh, I thought it was a lot of fun. Mm. No, this is like I'm having very similar on normal difficulty. It's a very sort of similar, maybe a little bigger, grandiose, prettier experience. But
sort of in like this cleanup time, having knocked off Tomb Raider and Infinite back to back. And I was thinking like, what am I going to play? And I'm like thinking about cleaning up some stuff. I wanted to play something new, but then I'm leaving on vacation week after next. I didn't want to get and drug into 2 things. I got Nier, and
are you going to play Nier?
I'm
really
super curious to play Nier. Yeah,
bless you.
Sorry.
Well, you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but like,
I'm not.
After all of the way people are like, there's the whole side of like, oh, it's a poorly done game, but then the whole side of people who talk about the things that appeal in it, I think are right that those are things that would appeal to
me. It is a deeply flawed game with flashes of brilliance. That's how I would describe it.
That's me.
Like Deadly Premonition style?
I mean, Nier is the origin of more fun than it is good. That's the game that I first said that about.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's more fun than it is good. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. I like fun.
Yeah.
I love fun. Fun is my middle name. Deeply flawed, but tragically fun. All right.
I think you'll like it. In that case, you'll have serious complaints about it. But.
So I have to see how it slots in, though. So I've been thinking about like what to catch up on, and I'm also playing Monster Hunter 3 Unlimited, which is awesome, or Ultimate, which is awesome. What I realized, I was like, wow, this is so deja vu, and then I remembered, oh, that's right, I played Monster Hunter 3 Tri on Wii, and this is the same game. Yes. I just have to get past all the stuff that I was doing when I was in 3, which. I'll get there.
Yeah.
And people are having, I think, a tremendous amount of fun playing online because online is definitely where it's at, right? I mean, the online is absolutely where it's at in that game.
Is it competitive or cooperative?
It's cooperative. So basically, Monster Hunter 3 takes the best part of an MMO, which is the grouping together, everybody playing in their role and having something that is theirs to do, fighting against a big boss, and makes that into a hunt. And that's the context of your game. You get together, you gather your friends, you talk about what you're going to go fight, and then you trek off into the wilderness to go find this big monster and bring it down by combined arms of your group.
Now, how do you talk to each other?
You talk.
Use your words.
Like, is there Wii Speak? You're on headset? It's Wii U, right?
Yes.
So I've never done the
Wii U pad thing lets you communicate with real people. It's revolutionary.
And the voices come out of the tablet?
It's amazing. It's unreal.
That's nuts.
It's futuristic.
That was my favorite part of LEGO City Undercover. Did we talk about that on this show? I don't remember.
Somebody did. I don't remember who.
Oh, yeah. No. Shram, I think. No? Who was it?
Marcus,
yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Forget it.
Whatever.
I really enjoyed the communicator aspect because it's like you have your character has a Wii U tablet in his hand and he pulls it out and he talks and then it's like the person talks to you through your thing. It's a cool thing.
Because in the future, everyone will carry those around.
Of course they will.
Or in the LEGO present.
However, to be completely... What was I lost my train. I lost
Monster
my train
Hunter, about, talking to your friends, having best a part of an MMO.
You guys are just being silly now.
No, you said best part of an MMO is the grouping with your friends. It's got that.
Taking down
and,
a boss.
And then you were going to say...
Water is wet and the sky is blue.
So how is it selling? I know the Wii U hasn't been doing as great as Nintendo hopes.
It's huge.
We don't get a lot of transparency on that. I think that it is as ever a fans game in North America that is yet to show it's still too off-putting to get someone in. You have to go into this game acknowledging the fact that you're going to spend the first 6 to 8 hours going through a very long and drawn out and treats you sort of like you can't put things together fast enough tutorial.
Why don't they change that?
Because that...
Why don't they change that? Why don't they make it bad?
I said it's huge in Japan.
Just push
the
better button.
They want to make more money in America. Why not like make some compromises and then make it big in America? I just feel like that's a great idea.
This is the philosophy that ended with colorization of black and white movies.
I suspect that Monster Hunter is so enshrined in, like, right. It's so popular over there that, you know, even good design changes are hard to make without alienating the fan base. I mean, that just seems to be the case in a lot of games that have.
Yeah.
It's better. Who cares?
I think better would be in the eye of the beholder. This is a case where the game's success and its love relationship with its fans is based off of a lot of the things that it does, and it does so well. I mean, there are a number of systems in here. Crafting is a huge part of this game. A big part of the game is the going out. The reason you would go back on these hunts after you've done them is to farm those creatures for their important materials that then let you craft better, bigger and better armor and weaponry for yourself. And it's a really cool loop. I mean, that is a very appealing loop of, I have these tools in my weapons and my abilities and my team that I put together to go out and fight these monsters that by myself would be very hard to bring down, that I can then harvest, you know, scales and different, you know, organs from, and bring back and then craft into the things that'll help me get stronger and do more in the game.
Mm-hmm. So I got to kill more monsters so I can get better gear. So I can kill more monsters so I can get better gear.
But the
so I can kill more monsters.
Exactly.
MMO.
It is MMO-like in that regard, right? But I mean, that's the fun of it. And then it's just really, it's really something. And when you get into higher levels and start taking down serious monsters with your group, it really becomes a, it gives you that rush and reward. Remember, like, that whole relationship of, like, how much you put into it net results and how much you net out of it. You net a lot out of this because you put a lot into it.
And some of those are like half hour, 45 minute battles.
But that's the other thing, is that they're only half hour, 45 minutes. So it's kind of, you don't have to do all of the other parts of the MMO to get there. Right. Mm-hmm. You just have to do the crafting and servicing part and then the going out and having the most fun part. And that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. That is cool.
So,
hey, I know none of us went to PAX, or excuse me,
GDC.
GDC, or PAX East for that matter. But there was some fun stuff that I was hearing about that I wish I had seen. Were you guys following?
For instance,
like the new Supergiant game?
Oh, yeah. The trailer for that.
What's it called?
I can't for the life of me remember off the top of my head. It looks amazing, though.
Amazing.
It's another isometric, like, thing, but it's...
But, like, it's like this awesome hybrid of turn-based and real-time combat, so at any point you can sort of pause the action and tell your guy, like, I want you to run over here, smack that dude in the face, go back over there, do a combo to that dude, run over, and then you can, like, set that all up, and he'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Is this new, or brilliant. Just the same one they had last year at PAX?
No. This is the follow-up to Bastion.
Yeah, the first trailer only came out a few months ago, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
This is not going to be out for, like, another year at least.
Because there was a game, an indie game at PAX East, I think last year, that kind of sounded, the gameplay sounded very similar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anything quite like that, where it's...
I wish I could think of the name.
I wish you could, too. That would be very
Anyway, YouTube yourself some Supergiant, and I'm sure you'll find it.
What was it called, man? Trans something or something?
Yeah, it starts with a T, I think. Yeah. But I, for the life of me, I
Transistor.
Know. Yeah.
Transistor.
Yes.
It looks awesome. Looks awesome. Anything else you guys saw at the GDC stuff or Boston?
Nothing popping to the top of my head. I mean, a lot of those sort of announcements and hands-on were things that I had, you know, seen or heard about before. Yeah. So, but I mean, looks like there's
that game looks really cool.
It does look really cool. Oh, well, and they're first, they've definitely got a. I will give them money for whatever their next effort is.
Bastion, I have such a deep love for that game. Mm-hmm. Such a deep love for that game. I think it is still underrated. Even now,
underrated.
I think it is.
I think it was pretty well universally loved and highly critically acclaimed.
Not enough in Jeff's eyes.
Not in Jeff's eyes. Not enough.
Well put, Nicole. Well put.
It does what it does very well.
Yeah. It's so deep, and
so much
the
narration.
Combat system is so fun. And there's not narration in Transistor as well, but it's a different kind of...
Morgan Freeman this time? They went for it?
No, it's no penguins.
Get busy living or get busy dying.
You know what we didn't see out of GDC was still much of any leaks about Xbox's next console.
Yeah,
they're doing really.
It's got to happen.
Of course it is. I mean, we've like seen rumors about the controller. I think that we'll see something prior to E3 from them because they're going to do their own unveiling. I mean, obviously after Sony's unveiling, and I think that they're maybe now that they've waded past GDC, they could get an interesting pop by being like the first heralds of E3 and maybe ride on the excitement that they hope to have out of that. I'm surprised though that this rumor about it being always on has come back again.
The Twitter thing that happened yesterday.
Tell me about the Twitter thing. I missed this one.
I forget his name. Gosh. Adam Orth, is that his name? Is that his Twitter handle? One of the uppers at Mike uppers. One of the big guys at Microsoft tweeted about how what's wrong with always on? Always on is the future. Always on works. You wouldn't buy a vacuum if you didn't have electricity. And like weird tweets that people kind of freaked out about and probably took completely out of context. But he was, you know, this big guy at Microsoft saying always on is the future. And it's going to happen.
And so they're bundling all 360 consoles, new Xbox consoles with Google Fiber.
I would like that. You know, give me that.
Yeah, but
you,
I mean,
you and your ideas.
Well, I mean, that's what kind of what they're talking about, right? Is like, I mean, he's saying, oh, well, you know, if you're a gamer, you've got internet, but it's not ubiquitous at this point.
Not at all.
Not even
close.
What sparked
this whole conversation was a story that Kotaku ran. That was based off of a rumor that they ran from what they said was a source in development community who said that as far as they had seen, you know, the always on connectivity part of consumer units was still in the plans, and that basically would be that when you started up your new machine, it would have to have a connection to the internet to do anything. And then he had some piece about like if there was like a 3-minute disconnect window that it would absorb, you know, like if you were periodically on and off the internet. This is if this were accurate, it would be by far the new high watermark for absolute arrogance and hubris by a platform winner from the prior generation. Mm-hmm. And I cannot imagine that Microsoft is dumb enough to do that because it just makes no sense.
Yeah.
What if they do? I mean, is it possible? Because I agree with you. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's the future. It's the farther future. As a country, we do not have the internet infrastructure to sustain always on. I mean, I have a router in my house. I'm not always on my Wi-Fi devices. I'm booted off all the time.
You turn off your router?
Yeah, turn it off. But then 30 seconds later, I turn it on again.
Wait, what? Yeah. Just to reset it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Because you need to do that?
Yeah. I get booted off.
You get booted off your wireless router?
Yeah.
You should look into that. You shouldn't have to do that.
Well, I mean, we have probably like 8 devices in our house all the time.
Oh,
so
that's why I have the same problem. Mm-hmm. So like 2 roommates, we each probably have at least a couple. I probably
phones,
have like six devices. So you got a couple consoles on, like 3 phones, a couple computers.
Someone boots up Netflix and then my laptop loses Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my point is, we're not there yet. But what if this guy at Microsoft was talking about kind of the idea that my phone's always on? Even if I'm not on 3G, I could be on Edge. Like, could a console utilize that network? Is that insane? Am I crazy?
Well,
isn't that a network that's already implemented?
Yeah, but that's still, well, I mean, I guess that could be part of their monthly fee that they require, but.
I mean, like MiFi, LTE, something like that, have that built into the console?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because, I mean, it's just not reasonable to expect people to always have Wi-Fi on.
What if it
or a broadband or a tradition? It's not reasonable to expect everybody to have a always on traditional,
especially when you're marketing
connection.
An entertainment device, not just a gaming device. Like if I want to put a DVD in, like I shouldn't, or if I have a DVD on my Xbox, like stored, I shouldn't have to be on the internet. I'm a dreamer, so.
It's the Ubisoft early DRM crap all over again for single player content, you know. It's that
we're
doesn't work.
I think we should all. We're talking pure speculation.
Oh, it's. It,
but we've been
I mean,
that's,
I'm
so
kind
long.
Of actually
when
saying I think that
fire.
the speculation over this is.
I don't know this.
It could have been brinksmanship. I mean, I think that there is a potential argument that Microsoft was, you know, testing the water, so to say, and seeing, you know, oh, how far can we push this? Could we get Sony to actually buy into this idea? Would they do it too? Especially now that Sony hasn't gone that direction and has certainly completely captured the whole, we're going to be developer friendly. This is going to be an easy game system to work on. They have a tremendous amount of love and momentum now for PlayStation 4. To come out with something that would be so at the opposite end of the spectrum would really be foolhardy.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
Indeed.
I don't think we need to worry.
All right. So we'll take a little break. When we come back on the other side, we'll do Defiance and story time.
Sure, you can pay $60 if you want to play a video game. But what if you want to play all the latest video games? Try Gamefly.com, the number one video game rental service. Right now, you can sign up for just $5.95, their lowest price ever. Gamefly has over 8,000 titles, including the hottest new releases like DMC Devil May Cry, The Walking Dead, and Hitman Absolution. And here's how easy it is. Just sign up, select your games, and Gamefly will ship them directly to your door. You can keep the games as long as you want, there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. Once you're done playing a game, send it back, and Gamefly will send you the next available game on your list. Now, you can also play hundreds of PC games with Gamefly's new Unlimited PC Play, which is free for members. Gamefly also saves you money by letting you try your favorite games before buying them. If you really like the game you're playing, simply click Keep It on the Gamefly website, and it's yours at a deeply discounted price. And if you're still unsure, which you shouldn't be at this point, but if you're still unsure, we're offering our listeners a special offer. This is just for Weekend Confirmers. Go to gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed for an extended 15-day free trial. That's gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed and sign up today.
All right. So one of the games I did hop into was Defiance. And building off of the Xbox thing, there's a lot of folks who have been trying to play this on Xbox that are very frustrated. And Defiance, if you haven't been keeping up with it, is a game from Trion Worlds that goes hand in hand with a new sci-fi series. And the idea originally that I thought was going to be was that you'd be playing along with the series, but it's really not that at all.
No,
it's
same world, shared world.
Shared world, shared sort of fiction, but the...
One thing's happening in this corner, another thing's happening in this corner, and rarely the twain shall meet.
Yeah, you're
very
rarely. In the game, you're in San Francisco. Specifically, you start off in the North Bay, and in the show, apparently, it's in St. Louis.
But every once in a while, a character from the show is referenced in the game, but not very often.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole, like, meta universe shared world thing is not quite as crossover-y as I thought it was going to be.
St. Louis is the Midwest San Francisco, right? No, not really.
So the other thing is that they took an interesting model to this game in that it's a $60 box product game, but it is an MMO. There's no subscription fee to play monthly, but it does have microtransactions in it for cosmetic stuff. And also for box unlocks. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of they're walking that line there as well. What I was going to say about the Xbox is that it's out on PS3, 360, and PC. Evidently, they're having a tremendous amount of trouble with their 360 server structure in general. And it's really lag-ridden. And they're having a lot of trouble with that. And while that's a problem, and obviously, especially if you spent $60 in the game, it's really annoying... One thing that they've done, I think that's an interesting example of how to handle customer service versus how not to with, say, SimCity, is they've been super transparent and super communicative of what's going on. Like, I was in their forums last night, and there's this ridiculously long set of posts where they've been keeping up with, like, here's what we've been doing. Here's what we're trying. Here's what we've tried. We tried this. We tried this. And at least you get a feeling of, wow, these guys are really dug in and trying to figure it out. You know, like, they were explaining that, hey, you know, we are network engineers, and the problem we're having with the 360 isn't just a network code problem, and it isn't just something where we screwed up the code. It's we didn't foresee how these servers are going to network within one another, and we're having problems with how they're responding to one another and sharing all the load, and we're working on it as hard as we can. So I think that's good. It's not good if you spent $60 and wanted to play the game, but...
Yeah. how are the people... our fans seem to be an equal combination of pissed off and understanding.
That I think speaks to why handling this up front so quickly and being transparent about it is important, is that people were very upset and are still very upset. But at the same time, at least they're getting some communication back and they feel like there are people who like the people who have decided that they don't want to play the game because they're frustrated with it are returning it. And the people who don't are like, OK, there's people working on it. It's going to get someplace.
Right.
As to whether you want to play the game, well... I'm playing it on PC, and I think Jeff Cannata would love this game.
Really?
I think he would love this game because it reminds me a lot of Terra, but done more like Borderlands.
It don't look like Terra.
Because it's not in fantasy world, you mean?
No, because it's not gorgeous, pretty, delicious looking.
Have you played it on PC?
I haven't played it. I mean, I played it at E3 last year. That's what I'm basing it on. So maybe a lot has changed, but...
I would say that while it's not gorgeous, it's not terrible on PC. And I think that sounds like that's one of those stupid endorsements. How does it look on PC? On PC, for the size and scope of the game, it looks pretty good. You know,
like an MMO. MMO graphics kind of look a little toony, a little scaled back.
It's not toony, but
I would say that
back, right?
Art direction is sadly a weak point for it, which is a little weird because I expected more coming out of a TV development world where costuming and set design is such a big thing.
Yeah, no, it's sort of a generic post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, it very much has that sort of sci-fi movie of the week. We pulled some stuff off the shelf and look, here's a battle rifle and here's a dude wearing some cobbled together armor. And
so conceptually tying the game to a show, how is that, like, have you watched the show? I mean,
the show, has it premiered yet? I actually, having played the game now, I am sort of curious to watch the show. The fiction of the world is just debuting now. It's debuting in April, so I don't know whether it's debuted this week or next week. The fiction of the show is a future Earth where aliens have arrived. There was a huge terraforming operation going on. The world was beat down, but through this battle of defiance, which I haven't really figured out what the hell it's all about.
Ding, ding.
Has started to fight back. And so now there's a ongoing conflict for the future of the Earth. And it appears that the humans have gotten a hold of at least some technology, because the game begins with you on a freaking giant battle cruiser ship flying over San Francisco. So
the it's a cool concept. I mean, if they had debuted a Battlestar Galactica game with the Battlestar Galactica show and both had been awesome, I would have been thrilled.
If this was Battle for Caprica, people would be super high
on
it.
If this turns out to be an awesome show that everybody gets on board with, that's great. It's risky because it's two things that need to be good. And one of them could certainly fall off if the other's stellar. Like, if it turns out to be an awesome game and the show tanks, there's no reason that the game can't continue.
What's the likelihood?
And vice versa.
Though? I mean,
because it sounds pretty generic.
Not great. But yeah. I think what's more likely is the game tanks and the show keeps going.
Yes,
which is certainly possible.
I don't think the game is going to tank. The game's actually, I was thinking about this last night. Though it is fairly well plowed sci-fi land, it's a pretty fun game. As the more I got into it, the initial playing of the game is it's a third person shooter. You do want to use cover quite a bit. And much like it has been equated to Borderlands, and I think the reason it's been equated to Borderlands is
ATVs
that...
ATVs everywhere.
Well, you ride ATVs. But I mean, I think the reason, moreover, the reason I think it's been equated to Borderlands is that it is a shooter and you play it like a shooter, but it's not as precise driven as like Crysis 3.
Okay.
So Crysis 3, you're playing a shooter, right, and you're hitting a guy in the elbow or the shoulder or the knee, and it's all of those sorts of things. Here it is, you're striking him in the body or you're striking him in the head, and you get a headshot bonus. Well, there is like crit bonuses for headshots, and it still isn't. It plays like that's the thing about, you know, Terra, you like it because it's an MMO that plays like an action game.
Yeah.
This is an MMO that plays like a shooter, and it's a cooperative PvE open world where everybody's playing in the world. So already, much like Terra, I've already encountered, while I'm out on adventures, just having that organic nature of, I'm doing something, a couple other people come up, they're in the world.
Right.
They just naturally sort of get drawn into what I'm doing. Like, I'm fighting a battle and I'm being chased or I'm on an attack, and they just sort of join in and then go off and do whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's really fun. That is really cool experience, and especially in a shooter world where it's a little bit different than what I've done before, because no one's dropping in and casting spells and doing magic. It's like someone comes in and they're a sniper, so they're standing back over here and sniping, and someone else comes in and they've got a shotgun, so they run up into the front of the battle, and I'm running, you know, in the mid perimeter with my assault rifle and taking cover and chunking a grenade, and so you start to get these really kind of cool battles. Then it ends and everybody gets their loot and someone goes off and does their thing and you go back on and do your thing, and it feels like you're in this world, which fits with the fiction.
Right.
Which is that it's this sort of destroyed world where alien artifacts have hit the ground, and those are the Arks, and you're an Ark hunter out trying to find this tech. And that all sort of really goes together well. And there's a series, and much like Borderlands, there are primary quests to drive the story along. There's secondary quests. Mm-hmm. They've learned off of things that, you know, your ATV, like you talked about, that's your mount in essence, mm-hmm. and it's instantly summonable any mm-hmm. place you are. So you tap up on the D-pad or press E, and it's like, here's your ATV, you're ready to rock and roll, and you can get around very quickly. It's initially a little bit like, oh, there's some jank here. You know, oh, the animations for these guys is not that great. Oh, the art style, it's not really doing anything for me. But then, yeah, this is a cool world that's put together, that is well furnished, that has enough little toys and fun. The character system is quite interesting. So you have this deal called the ego system, which is, it like pulls from different games. You can like sort of get the sense. You get a sense of where it pulls a little bit from Halo, in that you've got a shield over health and the shield is recharging. But you've also got this virtual holographic avatar chick who is the ego system that's in your suit.
Is her name Lortana?
Nakorda?
That sounds a lot. That sounds a lot like Halo. Just saying.
Anatork? No, it's not. But that's cool because it's something you're familiar with, right? But then it ties into the like RPG system, in that you gain ego powers. And so they don't have a class system per se. They have four different powers. And in the beginning tutorial, they show you these four powers. So, for instance, there's a stealth power, and there's a rush power. And then there's a grid inside your menu system that, once you've chosen your core power, lets you build perks off of that, almost in a sort of like the Final Fantasy sphere grid sort of thing, right? So you've chosen the starting spot. I went with the stealth. And now, building off of stealth, there's a number of perks that, as I build up ego points, I can put into these perks and equip them on my character that are based off of stealth. But as they start to move up towards one of the other powers, they start to take on characteristics of that power too. So if I go stealth towards the melee, then my stealth skills will start to incorporate more of things that are also in tune with a melee attacker. So they might be more focused on coming up from behind on an unsuspecting person and killing them. Right. Whereas I go more towards, say, the bullet power side, then they'd probably be more focused on like being concealed and sniping. And that's a really cool like, that's a well thought out skill system. Right. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that. I thought this was a pretty cool idea.
Is it something that you're drawn in enough? I mean, it sounds like you'd be playing it for a bit anyway, just to see how it comes along.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, It was definitely fun, and being different from Borderlands, and it being an MMO, so it's not Borderlands, this is something where I feel like I can dip in and play, but I'm not playing it with somebody right now. So I can dip in and play, and organic things will happen, and then I can pop back out and not play for a while. Although I do understand that once you get into San Francisco proper, it ratchets up the difficulty pretty high.
Co-oping is probably more required at that point.
Yeah. But you're going to do that anyway. I mean, that is ultimately the goal of an MMO, is to get you playing with people. So the early on parts are very soloable. Everything I've been doing for the first couple of hours, super soloable and pretty fun to do. Hmm. And like I said, I was actually very surprised. It definitely, Jeff, would fit into the more fun than it is good, because there are absolutely some issues there with it being a little janky. Even on PC, look, I mean, we've known that they had server issues, but in addition to that, on PC, I'm seeing stuff that I haven't seen in, you know, 3 or 4 years, with, you know, characters kind of popping around sometimes, like, you know, that little like, mm-hmm. oh, he's there, oh, he's 3 feet over to the right, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I suspect that they will smooth those out. I think that this is a game that, by virtue of that tie, they had a hard launch. I mean, there wasn't any, oh, we need to keep tuning or we need to keep going sort of thing. And for having a hard launch, you know, they've gotten it off the launch pad on PC. Apparently on PS3, they're having some struggles with 360, but I'm shockingly like sort of having fun with it. This could definitely be like a popcorn, you know, pop in and, you know, have a beer, screw around sort of game for a little while, and pop back out and come back to it a little later. And the cool thing about it is, being an MMO but not a subscription MMO, that it, you know, drop your $60 on it, and then you can do that. You can drop in and play it whenever you want to and drop out and not feel like, oh, I'm sinking $15.
But couldn't
there
be like a season 2 expansion that you need to pay $30 for?
Sure, of course. I'm sure that's how they're thinking.
Well, they did do that already. So there's a
okay.
There is a season pass, But the season pass is for all of the DLC packs. So they plan to, it's weird. It is a weird model. It's like selling it like a $60 game with planned DLC packs, but it's an MMO, and there's also microtransactions for cosmetic stuff.
But I think the biggest thing is that there's a TV show that goes with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the bummer is that everything you've said is like, oh, it's got cool mechanics. It's a fun, I can have a few beers and jump in, jump out, which is great, but you would think that the hook would be there's this great fiction behind all of this because it's built on a fiction that is supposed to endure as just fiction.
I guess we don't know the fiction yet.
Well, the
right?
fiction, no, we know.
As far as the show goes,
the fiction could be cool. The fiction could be cool. The drop into the game, not spoilers, the drop into the game is that you're on board this cruiser that is headed to San Francisco. You're an ark hunter, and you're working for this prominent scientist who has become legendary because he is trying to assemble this tech to stave off all of the terraforming that's happened to the Earth and restore the Earth, just restore the planet to a more human compatible condition. Mm-hmm. And as you get into the San Francisco area, your ship comes under fire. It's shot down, and you land through an escape pod on the surface. You're up in Marin. You're up in north. You're on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge, mm-hmm. and there's a command center that's set up there where the ship went down. And of course, the scientist has disappeared. So you're trying to you have multiple choices on how you proceed. You'll do some things to sort of get yourself ingratiated with the commander of this ship because the military forces that brought you there, they're not really in love with the Ark Hunters. They're more like, we're doing our thing. This is important. So you want to do some things to like get in good graces with them.
Buy them flowers, chocolate. It's typical stuff. Mm.
Yes, exactly. But then you're also going to want to start doing
10 bear pelts and 13.
You're also going to go out and do
radish
some investigating.
Roots.
Well, no, it's more missions like, hey, there are snipers up here on this ridge. We need you to take them out so that this group of survivors who are trying to get to us can make it through this valley.
Yeah.
And so you have to circle around, figure out how to get up there. That was actually a pretty cool mission. And then the other side will do things to start investigating with your ego unit, trying to find where the professor is because you've got to go find him. His life signs are still there. He's alive, but you got to go find him. So it's all like an escape from New York sort of vibe, like go find the guy and he's out there someplace. And at the same time, then there's also pop-up missions that involve the mutants. And again, also like Rift, there are pop-up events,
right,
called Ark Falls,
yeah,
where these artifacts will fall from the alien ships that have been defeated in the sky, and then when they fall and hit, then there's an event that happens in your local region around the Ark Fall.
That's what I played briefly. It's cool.
And the other thing that's cool is like the again building in that not having a weapon system. I'm not having a skill a level a character class system. All of your skills are built off of usage. Mm-hmm. So it's a dungeon siege model, right?
Yeah.
It's you use a sniper rifle, you keep getting better at sniper rifle by using the sniper rifle. Right. You use a shotgun, you keep getting better at shotgun by using the shotgun. Mm-hmm. There's mods and upgrades to your weapons. There's a lot of cool things. There's a lot of cool systems in here. Unfortunately, the other thing that's really bad to finish this up is that the UI, and I don't mean the like on-screen HUD, but I mean all the menu systems to go through all this stuff is sort of a wreck.
It's built like a cable box.
It's
a tie into the TV show.
It's functional.
it's relatively functional in that if you like navigating through menus and can figure out the arcane logic that someone decided to put what menu as a submenu of another submenu, you'll probably be okay.
It's can like you a customize?
Well, no, because that's the UI? Not the UI flow.
Okay.
Not the UI flow, because the UI flow, we're talking about the menus. You know, it's like they have all the menus laid out. Like, for instance, to log out of the game, you go to settings.
Sweet. Of course. Of course.
I'd like to change my setting of whether this game is on
or off.
It was very weird. Like I was playing the first time I was playing the other night, I was like, hey, how do I log out of the game? I hit escape. Nope. That's not the button, obviously. I pull up the menus. I'm like, there's no logout menu. There's no login and logout. I'm going to go through everything, finally get to settings. Why would log out be under settings?
That sounds like a game within a game.
After everything you said to make this game, to sell me on it, I think the only way I'd really get into it is if the show was really amazing and I wanted to be a part of that. So for me, the cool, because to me this sounds like a cool MMO, cool game. I don't need to play it because it kind of sounds like a bunch of games I have played. But if the TV show is good, then I can see myself really getting into this.
Well, that's their gamble, I guess.
Yeah. And as a rule, I mean, I think the idea of cross media stuff like that, like doing a TV show and a game, the principle of that is a good idea.
Well, for every show that you've ever loved, if you were like, well, we launched a game along with this, the problem is creating a show that you love.
Oh, yeah, no. And the problem is like there's always a focus, right? One is the primary property and the other one's sort of like the, oh, yeah, let's do this other thing with this. And it never turns.
Well, I'd say that the counterpoint of this is that's ironic to me is that the cross-media part doesn't really do much or mean much to me, but that the game is way more fun than I expected it to be and bopping around that's in a good multiplayer shooter like that. I mean, somewhere,
that's kind of good that it doesn't rise.
Probably
and fall
someone out there right now yelling and screaming Planet Side 2 into their space that they're listening in.
MMO. Oh, yeah. I thought I answered
it right.
It's
story time.
Okay, we're wrapping this up.
Let's do this. Story time with Nicole.
How much time do we have?
You got 10 minutes.
There's a story you need to know. It's story time with Nicole.
Okay, so I'm gonna tell the story per Ozzy's request of Ocarina of Time, Zelda Ocarina of Time, for those no one who didn't know
my
that.
My God.
Okay, so I'm gonna try to do it very quickly because I took notes and it's kind of a long thing. Okay, so Zelda Ocarina of Time starts out with Link. Link is a little boy in Kokiri Village. Now, Kokiri Village is full of like little elf people who don't age. They all have like blonde or green hair. It's weird. So a fairy, Navi, comes to him, wakes him up in the middle of the night. He's having a bad dream. Kids have that. And he finally gets his fairy. He's like stoked because he hasn't gotten a fairy. Turns out, spoiler, he's not a Kokiri. He's actually a Hylian. So the fairy has to take him to the Great Dooku Tree, which is the giant tree that rules all the Kokiri children, Obs.
Hey!
And so to do that, he has to like crawl around and get a sword, and then he gets a wooden shield, and then he can go talk to the giant tree. Now, the giant tree warns Link of the evil guy in the desert who wants to take over this like magical power. I don't think he explains the magic triangles yet, but the magic triangles there are, you know about them. So in the Dooku tree, you kill a bunch of like Dooku scrubs and like Keese and Scotilla, and then you kill the queen Yamaha? Like the bikes? But with a G. And before you do that, you have to kill these Dooku scrubs. Now, there's three of them. So you have to kill the second one, the third one, and then the first one.
I don't want no scrubs.
And then the boss door opens. She like shoots her eggs at you, which really, I mean, in this political climate, is not something you want to talk about. So you beat that. You get the emerald, which is probably like my fourth favorite gemstone. So not really psyched about that.
What's
so
your first?
We're getting to it.
Diamond?
We're getting there, guys.
Is it rupee?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so then you get to leave the Kokiri Forest. But before you do, you say goodbye to Saria. And you say goodbye to her on the bridge. And that's like the first moment that I almost cried in a video game. Because she loves you.
We've established that you have no emotions.
Yeah, none. So then you go into the world of Hyrule. Hyrule is huge. Okay, so before you do anything, you should probably just go straight to the castle because you really can't go to Lon Lon Ranch yet, even though you can get there's cows there. You really can't sing to them. There's nothing to put in a bottle anyway. You don't have any bottles. So you go to Hyrule and you talk to Malin and you help Talon and you get a chicken. You get a chicken that caws. Cuckoos, what they're called. And then you find Zelda, get past all these guards. She tells you about a vision she's had, and you can see Ganondorf, and he's kneeling before the king. You never get to see the king, though, so I wonder what he looks like. No one has any ideas. So in that courtyard, actually, Easter egg, you can hit the window enough times that a guard will throw a bomb at you, or you can look in the mirror, and it's Super Mario 64 with a flying hat. So... Dude. So then you, after that, you go head over to Kakariko Village, and there you get a bottle. You should also go out to Lon Lon Ranch and get a bottle there, too, because Talon will give you his daughter Malin for marriage. But then he says, just kidding. But I think that there's fanfic out there for that.
I only take first answers.
Okay, so then you go to Kakariko Village, you get your bottle, you can hang out in the graveyard a little bit, do some side quests, get some heart pieces, but then you want to head up into where the Gorons are. Now, where the Gorons are, you're going to need to get the bracelet. Now, jewelry is very important in the first half of this game. I mean, I already explained to you the emerald. So this time, you need the Goron bracelet. The Goron bracelet allows you to pick up bombs. Now, you need to pick up bombs in order to blow up the... entrance to Dodongo's cavern. And to do that, you need to talk to Durania, and he really likes the mad beats of Saria. So you have to play him her song, which I think is Down Left Right, Down Left Right. So, you know, you go in there, get Dodongo's cavern, pretty easy dungeon. The Dodongo thing is supposed to be like a dinosaur, but he looks something like a dinosaur. Basically, you just run in circles, and then you chase him, and then he dies, and then he melts, and he goes, rah! and then a heart piece appears in his mouth, and then you get the Gorn Ruby. Now, I also like rubies, but not my favorite. Okay, so then you become a Gorn brother for life, blah, blah, blah. Then you go to my favorite gemstone. You go to the water world of Jabu Jabu's belly. So to get there, you have to talk to King Zora because Rudo's missing because, you know, little girls go missing. And then, dude, you find them, though, and safe and happy.
So then send out a search party.
So then you find another bottle. Bottles are really the key to this game because eventually you're going to want to put pink fairies in there. You don't waste your time with any of that potion shit, okay? Pink fairies.
I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Indeed.
Good. Okay, so then you get the bottle. The bottle makes, oh, look, she's missing. And then so you go into Lord Jabu Jabu's belly. To get in Jabu Jabu's belly, bottle again, you put a fish in the bottle, you put the fish in front of Jabu's face, and Jabu goes, opens his mouth, and then he sucks you in, and then you do the whole level inside his stomach. It's very Pinocchio. It's very Pinocchio in that regards.
Or Jonah.
Or Gears of War, too.
You're all right. okay, so then in there, you have to, it's being, like, infected by the evil that's being taken over Hyrule, and, oh, God, okay, so then you have to carry Rudo around, which is, like, the worst companion quest ever, because she literally just puts her arms, folds her arm and just sits on the floor, and you literally have to carry her around, but you can throw her things, and she can kill the, like, flying manta rays, and so that's great use of her. Okay, so you beat that, you get this, fight this amoeba-looking thing that when it explodes, it gets, like, hives, and it's really gross. Okay, so you beat that. And then she gives you my favorite, the Zora Sapphire, which is the Zora's engagement ring, which by giving that to Link, he also has to marry Rudo. So this guy already has two bitches. Can you believe this?
That's baller.
Yeah. So
got
then,
a lot of bitches, but he's got much more. Sorry.
I don't know. But he also has jewelry and gemstones, so he's going to get the ladies.
Link
so,
is blowing up.
Yeah, no. And he's not even wearing pants right now. He's wearing like the tunic.
You don't need pants.
This is pre-pants Link. Okay, so then he leaves that area, and he goes back to find Zelda, but oh my god, Zelda's escaping the castle because Ganondorf has brought the fire. He's brought the fire, and she and Impa are running away on a horse, and then the last second, lightning strikes, and she throws something into the water, and Link runs under the bridge, and it's the Ocarina of Time with notes for the Song of Time. And then, so, before you do that, you should probably get some heart pieces, but from there, you should probably just go straight to the Temple of Time to put the gemstones, the spiritual stones, onto the platform. This opens the Door of Time. And you see the Master Sword, and you're like, oh god, the Master Sword. It's kind of like Excalibur, but better. And then so you go to pull the Master Sword, but oh my god, something bad happens. And then, so what happens is, Ganondorf is in there too, and he's trying to get the Triforce, and you're trying to protect the Triforce, but you're not old enough to protect the Triforce, something Zelda didn't tell you. So then you get locked in time for 7 years with this really old guy named Rauru. He's a spirit sage of light, but he's also Kapora Gabora, the owl, in my opinion. In most people.
Zsa Zsa Gabora?
Kapora Gabora. He's the owl. He's the owl that asks you confusing questions like, did you not understand that? No or yes. And then you're like, yes. And then he says the whole question again. Everybody knows. So he explains to you that you've been locked in the Temple of Time all this time. Because you weren't old enough to wield the power of the Master Sword. So 7 years go by, you get out, and then you have white pants on.
Well, of course.
Okay. So then you exit out, and then this person stops you, but oh my god,
it's spring.
Sheik.
Everyone wears white.
It's a Sheikah. A Sheikah stops you, and his name is Sheik, and he has like really cool hair and purple eyes and really cool outfit, and he has a harp, and he's like, you need to save Hyrule and stuff. So then you exit out into Hyrule, and you see that the town is full of the undead, or re-dead. Re-dead, totally different than the undead. And you have to get away from them because they suck like half your life. And but if you kill them, they give you power, which is a total bummer because they don't suck your power, they suck your life. So what you want to do from there is go to Kakariko Village. You want to go to the graveyard, get the hookshot. You want to head over to... Before you do that, you definitely want to get a Pana. So you want to head over to Lon Lon Ranch. You want to win the horse race, which you do. Carrot distribution is very key in this. I mean, you know, supply and demand with carrots, it's key. So then you want to get a Pana and head over to the Forest Temple, which is in the Sacred Forest, which I bet you I could tell you the way to get there. Okay, so you go in, you go right, and you go left, and you go straight, right, left, right, is what I think it is to get into the Sacred Temple. Because if you take the wrong turn, you go out to the beginning. Okay, so then you're at the Forest Temple. I still have five temples, you guys.
We'll let it go as long as you need to.
This might have to continue to next week.
Okay, I could. Do you want me to keep going?
You can. Oh, well, there we could do you if you want to. You could come back in 2 weeks and do the.
This could be Zelda Part One.
To be continued, y'all.
Yeah.
So what's the cliffhanger?
The cliffhanger is you get to the forest temple, but you don't know how to get up there. You don't know how to get in there. And Navi keeps telling you to call Saria, but how do you call her?
Tune in.
Hey, listen.
Hey, listen.
Half the story, and now you know it's story time with Nicole.
I'm going to not be here for the second half.
You're going to have to tune in and listen, bro.
I know. I'm going to be like, wait.
How will you ever know what happens?
You're not going to know what happens.
That's
really just the first, like, third.
All right, so we have lots to go on that. We have lots to go on the show, too, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to officially draw the show to a close here. Because if you don't want to listen to the BioShock Infinite spoiler cast, this would be your opportunity to say goodbye, see you later, talk to you next week.
Avidazen.
Because the last segment I've been strong-armed into doing a BioShock Infinite spoiler quest, we will talk about the story,
Our feelings,
the emotions that ran very high.
Our favorite vigors, you know, normal stuff.
And all the meta stuff.
So there you go. So no finishing move this week. I hope you guys have had a fantastic week. For those of you who are leaving, I hope some of you will stick around and listen to the BioShock Infinite spoiler cast. But otherwise, that's your weekend confirmed, and we're ghosts. Yes, love is a universal language. Thank you, High Contrast. All right, BioShock Infinite spoilage time. Jeff and Jeff, you're the guys who wanted to do this.
Yes, we did.
Yes,
that's
we
because
did.
We've been talking amongst ourselves so much. We figured, hey, could be fun.
This is one of those games that like you finish and it's like there's a handful of movies that do this too, where you finish it and you immediately want to talk to other people that have
I will admit that I might be a little weary of it just from the sheer volume of conversation Ariel and I have had over this game. Mm-hmm. She is definitely in the BioShock True Believer camp.
What does that mean?
Which means what?
That she is super into the whole metaverse ending
I introduce you to Jeff Mattis?
That's where I am too, actually.
See, I don't know where I am, where I stand. I beat the game. I read every theory on NeoGAF. I've read all the charts that NeoGAF has supplied me with the ultimate thread of ending analysis that I've studied and thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't know where I stand on it. I kind of don't know how to feel. I know that there are some issues I have with the game as far as it posing issues, the race issues, the religion issues, kind of like the political hierarchy issue, and then just kind of putting those issues on the table and not addressing them again, which I think it would have been cool if they addressed that. And I also think it would have been cool if they addressed the science in this game, because I think that the science they're proposing is just really awesome. This whole quantum levitation, which it's not. I know it's not quantum levitation, but...
No, it's
but
fiction. They're, you can throw words around however you want.
What's her name? Rosalind? Lutece?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, they call it quantum levitation. Just because it doesn't fall doesn't mean it's not levitation. A magician does levitation. That's what she says. I listened to all those recordings like 6 times.
Cool.
All right, Mattis. Hit me with your meta shot.
All right. So we're going to go a step beyond the actual plot of the game. The things that really struck me, I think the sci-fi aspect of it is cool, and the whole string theory deal where, you know, you have basically infinite possibilities that all branch from, you know, 50-50 decisions that we make in our life, and it creates these alternate paths and universes. The thing that really – and again, if you haven't finished the game, you know, I hope you've stopped listening already.
Yeah. You've been warned.
We're in spoiler territory, but there is a segment where you go back to Rapture, which everybody's like, you know, totally blown away by, oh my God, I'm back in Rapture. How does this tie into the first game? The thing that I thought was really interesting about that is when you're walking through, to get to the bathysphere, you pass a sign that says bathyspheres are in lockdown. If you remember the fiction of the first game, nobody but an individual with Andrew Ryan's genetic code could operate the bathyspheres, which means that if you take the logical extension, because Booker could operate those, BioShock is actually a parallel alternate future version of Infinite where Booker and Jack are the same character. Andrew Ryan and Comstock are basically allegories for each other. The Songbird and the Big Daddies are an allegory. Elizabeth and the Little Sisters are basically different versions of each other. Tenenbaum and the Lutece twins are...
Except that Booker and Comstock are the same person.
Correct. Well, and Andrew Ryan cloned himself to create Jack. Or it's arguable that it's his actual son. But the cloning thing, to me, seems to make
Couldn't
more sense.
Couldn't he be Andrew Ryan?
Who?
DeWitt. Slash Comstock?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Age-wise?
But not the same person. In Infinite, you have one character who's out of their time continuum impacting another one.
Right.
They're in your, like, in the Fringe world, right? You're in, you know, if you haven't watched the Fringe show, I mean, it's all about these alternate multiverse worlds as well, where one person crosses over and has an influence on the other world. So that's markedly different than...
So what's to say that decision tree where Comstock is born, one of those possible pathways is not Rapture?
Or Columbia.
Either one. Or some other crazy utopian society.
But there's
society.
No indication. So the only thing that has been countered to this is that the opening scene to BioShock is the plane crash. Mm-hmm. And it could be that... Jack was coming in, you know, through another rift that caused the plane crash to happen at the lighthouse in the original BioShock, and that Jack really, although they never explored it there, that Jack never was of that time continuum in the first place.
Sure. But it could be implanted memories for when you're in a new place, you make up your own memories.
Could be.
And, I mean, the way DeWitt got to Columbia was this weird kind of thing. Maybe the way that you get to Rapture is a different weird thing, and maybe.
I just don't understand. I hate to be Grandpa Poo Poo Pants.
No, please.
No, please.
Because I think
by
all
means,
cool.
If it fits.
I do think it's all that's cool. Poo Poo Pants are white, by the way. Just saying. I think it's cool, but I don't think it adds up to anything. Like, what is that? What further ramifications does that have?
It's just a tie-in for me that I like.
It's a tie-in, but it's a tie-in to what end? It's a tie-in that it's cool for cool
to a
sake.
Bigger plan.
It shows the interconnectivity and the cyclical nature. I mean, the whole song of the game, right? Will the circle be unbroken, right?
Right.
That's a whole metaphor for will this whole thing, this loop that they're caught into, which Booker, player Booker, has gone through. I mean, the first time you encounter the Lutece twins and they're having you flip a coin.
You've already flipped that.
It's 123rd or 124th time you've done that, right? Which means that... In the BioShock fiction, there are constants and there are variables. The constants are, you know, the man, the lighthouse, and the city, right?
Right.
And you can also expand that to other constants. Like I said, the parallels between the characters and the factions in Infinite versus the parallels in the factions in the original BioShock. And it's basically, well. Let me go even one layer more meta with you in terms of something that Levine did that I think, or the designers did, that I think is incredibly cool and an incredibly cool nod to how all these decisions spin us off into other paths. In the end, very end of the game, where the Elizabeths drown you to basically prevent Comstock from ever being born, the Elizabeth on the furthest left that appears is the old character model from the original trailers that they were showing for Infinite, right? To me, that is Levine saying, look, as an artist, I go through multiple iterations. The story is a constant evolving thing. But at the end of the day, there has to be a resolution. There has to be some sort of, you know, you have to cut things and do things and refine things until you present your work to the world. And he was by including that character model, was making a commentary about his own journey and how many other possible BioShock Infinites that there were in his mind when he was designing that. but it's a callback to how they're all interconnected. They all inform one another, even though, and this is, you know, an artistic perspective as opposed to a metaphysical or a quantum mechanics perspective. But I think that those sort of things, that's a really cool thing to say with your art. Mm-hmm. A really cool thing to illustrate about the process and about, you know, shooters in general, right? You know, he's talking about all these constants. Well, the constants between BioShock and BioShock Infinite are mechanical as well, right? You have inventory that you manage, you know, stuff you pick up, guns you shoot, plasmids or vigors that you use. And in a sense, as a player, you're trapped in this, you know, cyclical thing. And that's pretty much every shooter that you play, right? There aren't a whole lot of those types of games that allow you to interact with the world beyond certain points of player agency.
Mm-hmm.
So that is basically illustrating that. Like, this is it's sort of an extension of, you know, this is a contained timeline, a contained story, and there's only so many places that you can make this diverge.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to end up in the same place. You flip the coin every time. It's going to be the same. There are only a few things in the game that you can actually affect in terms of differences, and they're pretty minor differences, right? They're narrative differences.
I love that, and it's part of what I heralded from the mountaintops when the first BioShock came out, and I still think BioShock the first is a stunning achievement for making narrative about interactivity, and that in order for that game to have landed the way it did, it had to have been expressed through an interactive medium. It could not have been a film, because in order for Would You Kindly to land the way it did in that game, I had to be the one doing everything. And I just feel like that message is so much less focused here and obscured, I think, unfortunately, by the narrative of Booker and Elizabeth, which is cool in its own right, but I think it is at odds with any kind of meta message that I find personally to be far more interesting and less common.
The BioShock meta message, it was a lot more. I mean, it was I think very. If they'd done the same thing in Infinite, it would have been the same game. It would have been, here's a utopian society, here are our ideals taken to their.
I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
I don't agree that they had to stay in that world. I think that I'm somewhere in between. But what concerns me, or doesn't concern me, what I think becomes almost a step too far is this desire that we seem to run into to really intellectualize the entirety of the discussion around BioShock, because there are some really incredibly cool, creative, and artistic elements that all come together into some great ways. So, for instance, by bringing in this idea of the multiverses and the cyclical nature, one of the things that, as you have a little light bulb go off at the end of the game, is that, wow, every time I died, that Booker did die, probably, mm-hmm. but I was now Booker number 147 plus one. And then I was Booker 148 plus one. And mm-hmm. and so I was like, you know, incrementing. And they were just like, the Luchans, they were just like reaching back into the multiverse and finding another Booker to bring in and throw into the fire. But then if I go a step further and really start burrowing down and trying to overanalyze this stuff, I start to ask questions that I think we run the risk of like ripping the fiction apart. Because if you're trying to create, look, the world around us is an incredibly complex web of interacting systems, right? And to do that in fiction is a monumental task. You could argue that, you know, George R.R. Martin did it. You could argue that Tolkien has done it. And I'm sure that the Irrational team has put together quite a bit of canon for BioShock world. But to do it across a multiverse and have it hold together under close scrutiny is really asking quite a bit. So, you know, for instance, I don't want to dig down so much that I get to the end and start to ask, wait, so Booker either stays Booker or becomes Konstok based off of the baptism, but then all of these Elizabeths somehow show up at this climactic moment, no real explanation for that, and then we kill one Booker and suddenly that fixes everything and all of the Elizabeths mm-hmm. that were spawned in all of those worlds go away?
That's because it's his daughter.
But he's... So he was...
He doesn't exist to have her.
Yeah. He was never born. She was never born at that point. Like, he snuffs himself out And the thing,
but he snuffs himself out in one iteration, not in all other iterations.
No, because the iteration, those multiple Comstock, all of Comstock's iterations began at the baptism. All of them, and all these millions of possible universes that have a Comstock in them.
But you see, there's never there's never an establishment that there is a master universe, and that demands that there's a master universe from which others. From which all the others are derived, right? Because otherwise, we've got just... So look...
It's all
derivatives. If we've got a bunch of Bookers, so we've got Booker 1, Booker 2, Booker 3, Booker 4, Booker 5, and they're all coming down to this baptism, if one of them has decided he's not going to get baptized, it doesn't preclude any of the other ones from getting baptized.
Wait, those are all the same Booker. Pre-baptism, those are all the same Booker.
That's but what I'm saying. There's no
why is there one universe before that decision point and infinite universes after that decision
Elizabeth
point?
Explains that she can see through all of the doors simultaneously, and she knows that this is the one place where you can end it all, right? As a writer, my inclination was, well, couldn't you – why did he feel like he needed to get baptized? Because of the Battle of Wounded Knee. Well, if you go back to the Battle of Wounded Knee and he never fights that or he doesn't have such a traumatic experience, could you do that? The thing is – the way that they explain that is Elizabeth is the omnipotent one, right? She can see into those and go, you know what? That's not going to work because if you don't fight this battle, you never get to this decision, and you're going to become something even worse, or it's going to create a whole different set of things. We're dealing with how do we prevent Comstock from ever existing in any reality? And the only way to do that is to go back to his inception point and completely wipe everything out. Now –
and that also assumes that there's only one Comstock, which they sort of like work into this fiction, this idea that by virtue of the Comstock that you're fighting, having gotten the gear from the twins, that he's somehow absorbing Comstock juice from other Comstocks across other multiverses.
He's using their rift machine that they created to – that's how they're stealing music from the future, right?
Or the tech to build a songbird.
If you see the barbershop quartet, you know, when they're going by, there's on the sign, it says, you know, songs from the future or songs of the future, right? They're basically taking stuff from.
Did you find the composer's office in the,
yeah.
At the end of the game?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's awesome. Well, and they have it. And the room that you lead up to before you go and kill Comstock, basically, there are placards detailing in bronze all of these major events that you've done leading up to the moment where you kill him. And the last plaque is him standing in front of an altar like he is right before you go and talk to him. So it's like he already knew. He was like – Comstock knows that he is going to get killed. The thing is after you kill Comstock, that hasn't wiped him off the face of the map because you're still Booker who is then going to go back and basically, you know, become Comstock after you've killed him. So it's like this weird sort of like – oh, we think we got him here. We've wiped him out. No, actually, he's going to exist in all these other millions of possible timelines that have been created when he was first.
Here's what I love about this. A, I could listen to you talk about this all day long. But B, just because you're articulating it extremely well. But B, this it reminds me of the like 2 weeks of lunches and dinners that I had with my friends after we saw Memento the first time.
Dude, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think I can come up with another video game that engenders that kind of analysis, discussion, introspection, and bravo, bravo. I mean, it's a truly gargantuan achievement. What I'm saying, and I love the game, don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is I really felt that the analysis that you're doing is awesome. The detail is there. All the layers are evident in the game. I wish that the delivery of that story gave me a moment of introspection in my own life rather than feeling like
the game's core central theme is about the choices that we make in life and what impact those have and living with those choices and
the knowledge that if you made the opposite choice in another universe.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, like I said, it's we're talking about multiple layers here. So for some people, the straight up fiction of the, another little spoilery thing. The whole thing about
spoilers. Hey, we're doing spoiler.
Yeah, I was talking about how does Elizabeth get this power? And it's like, well, the Lutessas experimented on her, but really
she exists in both
dimensions, right? So she is, her finger is in one dimension, she's in another dimension.
Tip of her pinky is in another dimension.
But that's cool, dude.
And doesn't die and decay and go away.
Her cells exist in two dimensions. Now, is the most important.
I believe Fringe touched on some of these motifs that are very prevalent in BioShock about being caught in two dimensions and trans-dimensional travel and all that sort of stuff. But everything that I look at and I go, well, how does that work? Everything that I've looked at, with the exception of one thing, which I'll tell you about in a second, has some sort of actual, you know, relatively ironclad hypotheses. Maybe a couple, but like,
let me just say this though: if instead and again, I love the game. Mm-hmm. I love the story. I love the game.
All right, we get it.
But if instead of revealing the backstory of the character that I had been playing's decision point, mm-hmm. I had been put in a situation where I made the decision in a similar way that the Would You Kindly, in retrospect, I, as a player of a game, was forced to do. I mean, it's about what you do as a game player, right? I have a task, I have a quest, I do it.
But of the way the fiction is set up there, though, you let the player play the baptism. They go, no, I don't want to get baptized, or yes, I do. They both have – basically, that just determines which of the two Comstocks you play.
Right, but I'm not suggesting a specific gameplay mechanic that is applicable to that baptism. I'm saying that – if in some sense the story worked out so that what is revealed to me at the end is that something that I participated in was even if I only had the illusion of choice, but if something that I did had that kind of effect rather than something I'm witnessing or something that I'm now just told about later that already happened, I think that would have been so much more profound.
Don't you think that happened already? Like, don't you feel like BioShock did that so well that it would almost be a disservice to do the same thing again?
No, I don't think it would be the same thing. I'm not saying I want the same thing over again. I'm saying that the game, I felt like the focus of the game became about Booker and Elizabeth. These fictional characters that I'm watching a story about, rather than about
you, Jack or whatever.
Yeah, about my impact on the world or my. I kept waiting for the game to be
But you're living a. I mean, they even set up that you're playing through something that character has experienced over 100 times already, and it's about finding those. Avoiding, you know, realizing what the constants are and then finding out what the variables are and then seeing if you can manipulate those variables to affect different outcomes, different timelines, or realities.
I think it introduces some cool ideas there as that course of fiction does whenever it's – whatever its vehicle is. My issue within the game, because I like Jeff, thought the last little bit of it unraveled some for me. And I think it's because, for my mind – the fiction needs to serve more masters than it can reasonably serve within the space of the game that it's trying to take place in. And by that I mean that you've taken me into Columbia, and I felt like I've had this involvement in Columbia, but we very quickly go rift jumping, and rather than developing a sense of how what has transpired and what happened through choices that were made impacted the world of Columbia, and it got to the place it became, the vehicle becomes the Vox Populi turn into this bizarre, bloodthirsty rabble, and the world really gets marginalized because it all just sort of falls apart, and there's this bloodthirsty weird thing.
And we're fighting ghosts and shit.
Yeah, that's where it jumped the shark for me.
Yeah.
Sorry, we jumped the shark.
Sorry to jump your jump.
You jumped on my jump. Yeah. But at that point, then my sense of place and purpose within that world has really unraveled. And yet at the same time, I'm not going so far down the rift jumping that I'm just like playing Doctor Who. And because I'm straddling this world of, it's like I've still got these two. The fiction's still trying to serve these two masters. It's like, I still want to tell the BioShock Infinite story, but at the same time, guys, I want to introduce the metaverse world. I want to give you all this feeling of like what BioShock, and I mean BioShock, the bigger universe.
Sure.
Of BioShock.
Franchise. Yeah. What I'm telling you, the franchise's story rather than this game's story.
Right, and I'm going to pull all that together in the last quarter of this game, and it sort of falls apart under the weight, and then. And then by the time you get to the and I got to talk about this for a second too. You get to the final defend the boat mission, and that's just bad. I mean, that was a bad.
Well, I had fun zipping around on the any time I got a chance to zip around on the roller coaster ride.
Yeah, yeah.
It is such it's a fun gameplay mechanic.
It was done so much better on every other opportunity than defend the boat. And if you played on hard, defend the boat is. Yeah.
Normal gave me a few moments of
You know what pissed me
crying.
Off? There's a moment that I was the one moment in the game, other than fighting the same ghost bitch three times, which is unforgivable.
And then her dead minions
unforgivable.
Over.
By the way, the tears in that area, the three tears that they make, total missed opportunity. Those should have been if those tears had been akin to the Eiffel Tower Tears for Fears song thing instead of just an audio clip with a little fucking window in it.
Agreed.
I wouldn't have had any problem with that mission. I would have been like, oh, cool.
Yeah, you sit there staring at it and just listening. You're staring at nothing, listening. Yeah. Anyway, but other than that, the only
Ghost
point...
Bitch is a bad fight the first time, much less the second or third time.
Never give me a boss I have to fight three times in succession in a video game ever.
That doesn't change. That is just literally the same fight and has an obnoxious mechanic to it.
And at the very end, real quick, Elizabeth says, I don't know if that's really my mother or my projection of my feelings onto her. Like, what did... Yeah, that's never explained.
So this ties into the... I'm sorry. Just real quick. This is the one thing that I'm hoping you or the listeners can help me out with. Lady Comstock, her first initial, based on stuff, media in the world and placards and stuff, her first initial is A. Elizabeth's original name is Anna. I don't know if there's some weird, like, beyond my comprehension mind fuck of Elizabeth is somehow...
Herself.
Her own mother. Or she is both Lady Comstock and...
We never hear who Booker got with to create
her. You don't know who her mom is.
Her mom.
I don't want to lose this moment because what I was working toward when I sidetracked is the first... One of the greatest moments in the early part of the game is when you have to leap to the airship, disable it, and leap off.
Oh, dude, so awesome.
One of the greatest moments. The first time I played that, I was so pissed because I felt the weight of what I was doing. I'm like, I'm fucking doing that. I'm leaping to an airship and leaping off of it. And then I disable the whatever that's the engine or whatever that's in the center. And it says, oh, get off. And I'm running around and I'm looking at trying to figure out how to get off. And I don't know how to get off exactly. And I don't want to do it wrong because I know it's going to look awesome when I do it. And I'm really excited about doing it. And I'm looking around. And evidently some sort of internal timer I wasn't aware of went off. And I just... keeled over and died.
Oh.
And then I reloaded having already done that.
No.
And Elizabeth goes, wow,
that was
that was amazing thing. And I was like, I didn't do it.
Oh, wow.
It was like someone stole something from me.
That's terrible. That's
I was so pissed.
That's terrible.
I have one thing that I want to know.
That's how Jeff lost his virginity.
Well, no, I'm not going to comment. Okay, so there's one thing that I think that is, I wonder if means something. There are a few Vox phone, audio box, whatever, of this girl named Constance. Mm-hmm. That she's this girl who is like alone, and I think she's Vox, so she's poor, and she is looking up to Elizabeth. She wants to talk to Elizabeth. And you find one of her audio recordings in the beginning. I think you find one at Lady Comstock's, like, her statue in front of the Comstock Manor. And she says things like, I really want to be Elizabeth's friend. I want to help Elizabeth. I relate to Elizabeth. And her name is Constance. And then the game's always talking about Constances. Like, I know it's different, but I feel like it's also such a coincidence is there something there? That she's this little girl named Constance?
It's funny you bring that up because there are so many things that I see. And I know usually in most cases, in most media, when people are seeing all this sort of stuff, it's... they really like the fiction. They've sort of got their head up their own ass a little bit. I am firmly convinced that a lot of this really subtle stuff and the reason that it hits me the way that it does is because there are things like that that are like, oh my God, this is way more complicated than simply this is another character. This is probably the most basic example I can think of is, you know, those two dolls, Dimwit and whatever.
Yep.
Okay. Those guys look almost exactly like the Pip-Boy style dude that introduces all of the tonics and crap in the first game, right? There are artistic, not the vending machine,
sure,
Circus of Values.
There's a
dude,
lot. There's a lot of family.
The same
there's
guy.
A lot of family
the
same guy. Genetics in there. So what do you think? So what do you think about the whole idea of one of the things that I did find from a fiction standpoint, mm-hmm, structure? I loved that it was bookended with baptisms.
Oh yeah,
and I have a question for you. Did you die in the opening baptism? And if you did die, why did you not do the door thing? Because it's the one time that I think that you died that you didn't do the door thing. So if you think about it, the opening in the mm-hmm opening of the game, you go up there and you get baptized. And if you remember that scene, it turns ugly.
Yeah, he's not clean yet.
And then it goes to white and you wake up in a new place.
And it's the same.
You stop struggling
guy as the other
you, you ostensibly you all the air comes out of your lungs. You mm-hmm stop struggling and you black out, and then you come to in Colombia with no one around,
right.
You pop out of the water. How would that have happened? How would you pop out of the water alive with consciousness?
The closest thing to an explanation for that is as you're walking up through the garden, there's one of the dudes standing there and he says something to the effect of, the prophet or Comstock fills our lungs with water so that we may breathe again or breathe fresh air. It's like some sort of rebirth thing about
right
fill, but he uses the words filling your lungs with water, which made me immediately go, okay, well, maybe that's part of the...
But could you interpret it as having been killed by... That
oh,
you
yeah,
died
yeah
and then...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They do that.
Then why wasn't there the door?
I don't know. Maybe the whole experience was something even different. I don't know.
I got to run.
Anyway.
I'm sorry.
Thanks for indulging our spoiler talk.
No, it's awesome.
Yeah.
I like that it wasn't just like, my opinion of the game. It was really like analysis. It was fun.
Cool.
It was fun.
It was great.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the BioShock Infinite talk. We will be back again next week. Work so hard that we play harder. Work so hard, don't you know we playing harder? Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. My body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta finish each round.